there remains an urgent need for follow-through and continued statesmanship by all sides.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. There are approximately 489,000 deaths globally from COVID-19, and in the United States, that figure is more than 124,000. The number of infections worldwide approaches 9.6 million in the U.S. It's more than 2.4 million. Brazil easily has the third highest number of deaths and infections. The COVID-19 pandemic is subsiding in Europe, but it's getting worse globally. The number of infections expected to reach 10 million next week, and the number of deaths 500,000. The head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, warned the international community that the virus is still circulating. Added, it was time to be on our guard, not to let it down. The former Ethiopian health minister said it could take a year before an effective vaccine against the virus that has caused the COVID-19 pandemic were to be invented. Tedros rejected criticism that China did not warn other countries about the epidemic early enough, saying it was not possible to compare its response time with anyone. He did praise the Chinese authorities for what he called the very strong social distancing and measures it implemented in Wuhan, where the disease was first identified in late 2019, and for being able to identify the virus at a record time. While the COVID-19 cases in the United States may seem like a staggering figure, government experts still believe the actual number may be 10 times that. Officials from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention this week said more than 20 million people in the U.S. could have contracted the virus based on results from antibody testing. If that estimate is correct, there is a bit of good news attached to it, which is that the virus would have killed a much smaller percentage of those with the disease than previously thought. This is VOA News. A spike in new coronavirus cases in Australia's second most populous state has seen authorities launching a testing blitz in an attempt to gain control. 33 new cases were recorded in Victoria within a 24-hour period, marking at least 9 days of double-digit new cases in the state and the biggest daily rise in 2 months. Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison says he remains optimistic about the response effort. Victoria State Premier Daniel Andrews said about 100,000 tests will be conducted over a 10-day period. The efforts to contain the virus will be supplemented by about 1,000 Australian military personnel. Final passage of a far-reaching police overhaul bill remains in limbo after the U.S. House approved the measure on Thursday. Both the democratically controlled House and Republican controlled Senate have tried to respond to the global outcry to the deaths of George Floyd and other African Americans. A bill sponsored in the Senate was blocked by Democrats. The House measure, referred to as the George Floyd Policing Act, has been backed by civil rights organizations. Among other things, it would ban the use of chokeholds by police, overhaul immunities for law enforcement, prohibit racial profiling, and ban no-knock warrants in some instances. The U.S. Supreme Court has strengthened the Trump administration's ability to deport people seeking asylum without allowing them to make their case to a federal judge. The High Court's 7-2 decision applies to people who are picked up at or near the border who failed their initial asylum screenings, making them eligible for quick deportation or expedited removal. And Justice Samuel Alito wrote the High Court opinion that reversed a lower court ruling that said asylum seekers must have access to the federal courts. Alito wrote that Congress acted properly in creating a system for weeding out patently meritless claims of asylum. The Trump administration has drawn up a list of companies from China that have ties to its military, which may lay the groundwork for fresh U.S. sanctions. They include tech giant Huawei, the video surveillance company Hikvision, as well as China Mobile and China Telecom, both of which are publicly listed in New York. The document was seen on and by Reuters, and a U.S. defense official speaking on condition of anonymity confirmed its authenticity and said the document had been sent to Congress. Huawei was placed on a trade blacklist last year over national security concerns, and Washington has led an international campaign to convince allies to exclude Huawei when setting up their new 5G networks, Huawei was placed in that trade blacklist last year. The Pentagon putting these companies on the list does not trigger penalties per se, but it's part of a 1999 law that says the president may impose sanctions. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, viewing this.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 26th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi's opposition says its candidate is leading in unofficial results from Tuesday's election.
From the unofficial results that we have actually won the election with a landslide. We are talking now of maybe 60% plus of the vote.
Tanzania opposition leader Zito Kabwe will talk with us about his arrest earlier this week. The coordinator of Gambia's COVID-19 National Response Program has resigned. Malawi tries new initiative to deal with food insecurity during COVID-19. And Ebola has officially ended in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo.
Today is a joyous occasion. I'm delighted to celebrate the end of the Ebola outbreak in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo. The Ebola response was a victory for science.
And families in Nairobi's low-income neighborhoods use community currency to pay for food during the COVID-19 pandemic. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The main opposition Malawi Congress Party says opposition alliance candidate Lastra Chakwera is leading incumbent President Arthur Peter Mutharika in unofficial results from Tuesday's presidential election rerun. The party also says the new leadership of the Electoral Commission exceeded expectations in organizing the June 23rd poll. MCP General Secretary Eisenhower Mukaka also said his group condemns pockets of isolated violence in parts of the country during the election. His comments came after the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP, expressed concern about violence against its supporters in opposition strongholds. Mukaka tells viewers Peter Clotty it is clear that the election was peaceful and transparent in spite of the isolated violence in parts of the country.
Do acknowledge that there were isolated incidents in two areas, there are two or three areas they mentioned in the central region. And we did condemn the violence that took place, which was basically a reaction of people to situation because, you know, people were alert and any rumor to the effect that somebody wanted to do something sinister, people reacted. But then, that said, and Mr. Dausi is being mean with the truth because our monitor was badly hacked and our monitors were chased in Molanje. One of our IT guys was actually beaten in Palombe, and our monitors were chased in Chikwawa. So, yes, you can see that there were pockets of isolated incidents of violence. And what the next chairperson has actually said is since this has been reported, these things are being treated as criminal activities, and they have therefore referred those cases to the police so that they can do investigation and arrest whoever broke the law.
Now, Eisenhower, are you therefore saying that the MCP, the biggest opposition party, is pleased with how the Electoral Commission organized and carried out this presidential election rerun?
Actually, to say we are pleased would be an understatement. Because the way the MEC chairperson, Justice Dr. Kachari, has performed, he has beaten everybody's expectation. One, they were challenged in terms of timing. There were just a few days remaining to the expiry of the court order. Secondly, the DPP government did their best to frustrate them by withholding financial support to the commission. So despite all this, despite all the challenges that were there, the commission has performed beyond expectation and have performed beyond reproach. We are extremely excited with how this new chairperson and the commissioners have actually performed.
What do you say to critics from the ruling DPP saying that the MCP took advantage of the lack of presence of both local and international poll observers to create a kind of cloud just to undermine the integrity of the recent presidential election rerun.
It is not true. The truth is that we've conducted the most credible election in the history of Malawi. And yes, we wish we had international observers. But if you ask any well-meaning Malawian, they would tell you that the way the fresh presidential election has been conducted is something that ought to be applauded.
Eisenhower Mukaka is the General Secretary of the Opposition Malawi Congress Party. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Lilongwe. A Tanzanian opposition leader says his arrest earlier this week and the revocation of the independent Tanzania Dema newspaper's license are all part of continuing intimidation and harassment by President John Magufuli's government against all fundamental freedoms. Zito Kabwe, leader of the Alliance for Change and Transparency Party, was arrested Tuesday, June 23rd, while meeting with his party officials. Kabwe, a staunch critic of President Magufuli's government, condemns the revocation of the Tanzania Dema newspaper's license. He describes the paper as the only voice of the opposition. Kabwe said the police arrested him and charged him with illegal demonstration and endangering peace.
Having an internal party meeting, recruiting new members from the local council in southern Tanzania, a region called Lindi, and the police just invaded the meeting and put us under arrest. 8 of us were arrested. They roughed me up a little bit and they sent me to a police station and later drove me for 4 hours in a pickup, outside of the pickup, in a cold environment, very rainy. So it was some sort of a torture. But we arrived in the town around 1 and they held up for another 30 hours until they released us. And they charged us on first illegal demonstration. We did not demonstrate, so there was nothing as far as demonstration is concerned. But later they charged us with endangering peace, which we totally don't understand because even the particulars of offense are not very clear.
Did the government say that you were arrested because you violated the policy on campaigning prior to the election?
We were not campaigning. We were recruiting members and it was an internal meeting.
Is your party planning to form an alliance with other opposition parties ahead of the election?
Yes, we are in discussions with the other opposition parties to have an alliance.
The Tanzanian government earlier this week revoked the license of the Tanzania Dema newspaper. As an opposition leader, what can you tell us about overall freedom of press and freedom of expression in Tanzania?
It is a continuing situation of intimidation against all fundamental freedoms. Freedom of expression, freedom of press, freedom of association. All these things have been done for the last 5 years under the current administration under President Magufuli. And the Tanzania Daima suspension is one of those kind of harassments, intimidation, and oppression going on in the country. And we have condemned the decision of the government of Tanzania to revoke the license of an independent daily newspaper, which was the voice of opposition anyways.
Coronavirus is wreaking havoc on a global scale. How is the government handling the COVID-19 in Tanzania?
Nothing. They're doing nothing. Actually, we are living in a very unique situation whereby the government has declared that COVID is no longer there in Tanzania, and more so, the life goes on as it is. There are no statistics given by the government. We don't know the number of cases, the number of deaths, the number of recoveries. We know nothing.
Zito Kabwe is the leader of the Opposition Alliance for Change and Transparency Party of Tanzania. He was speaking with us from the capital, Dar es Salaam. Amid a global pandemic, a glimmer of hope. The Democratic Republic of Congo has officially beaten its 10th Ebola outbreak, which raged for 2 years in the nation's volatile east. As top international health officials welcomed the news, they noted lessons learned in the Ebola battle that can be used to fight the coronavirus, which they say is surging on the continent. Viewers Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The 10th Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo has ended after 2 years and 2,300 deaths in the country's east. The head of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, announced Thursday.
Today is a joyous occasion. I'm delighted to celebrate the end of the Ebola outbreak in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo. The Ebola response was a victory for science. The rapid rollout of a highly effective vaccine saved lives and slowed the spread of Ebola. For the first time, the world now has a licensed Ebola vaccine, and effective treatments were identified that dramatically lower death rates when patients are treated early.
But he and other experts warned other threats menace that country and the African continent. Dr. Matsidisa Moeti, WHO Regional Director for Africa, noted that as this epidemic has ended, the coronavirus pandemic is growing in Africa. Congo has more than 6,000 coronavirus cases. The continent's coronavirus epicenter, South Africa, this week surged past 100,000 cases. And Moeti noted, Congo still has an Ebola outbreak, just in a different place. And other diseases are also menacing the population.
The new Ebola outbreak in Bandaka, in Equatorial Province in the DRC, along with measles outbreaks in the Central African Republic, in Chad, in the DRC as well, in South Sudan and other countries, and an increase in malaria in some countries in Southern Africa compared to last year, are all reminders of the need to ensure continuity of essential health services for other life-threatening conditions while at the same time fighting COVID-19.
She noted that there are now more than 332,000 COVID-19 cases on the African continent, and 8,700 people have lost their lives. But she added, this difficult path has been paved with important lessons that could be applied to the new pandemic.
One of the most important lessons that have been learned is the need to engage with, work with, enable communities to be knowledgeable, to be empowered to play their role in different ways. I think that was one of the most important lessons to come out of the Ebola outbreak. And it's extremely relevant for the COVID-19. Secondly, we've learned great lessons about how to innovate in the middle of a pandemic, how to learn, how to develop new technologies. The professor referred to the fact that at the same time as the response was going on, there was work to discover new therapeutics, a new vaccine. And then thirdly, we have seen the importance of the resilience of health systems. So one of the lessons that I take away is that we must invest in health systems when we do not have outbreaks going on.
Moeti said that if Ebola can end, there is hope that other infectious diseases can also be vanquished. But she stressed, the most important players are ordinary people. She urged everyone in Africa and beyond, wear a mask, wash your hands, and take care. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 26th. The coordinator of Gambia's COVID-19 National Response Program has resigned. Alassane Sangori says he resigned because he couldn't do his job as expected. As Pandero Umbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina, Gambia's Justice Minister Abubakar Tambadou has also resigned to take up a new position at the United Nations.
It was in May of 2020 when President Adama Barrow appointed Alassane Senghor as the country's COVID-19 National Coordinator. 1 month into his appointment, Senghor has decided to resign.
I resign on personal grounds, but I really don't want to go into the details. But it's just that, you know, I can't do my job as expected. The environment is not conducive for me to perform. That's all I can say.
Senghor is also the Secretary General of the Gambia Red Cross Society. He took a leave from his work to accept the government's job offer. Senghor wouldn't shed light on the main reason behind his resignation. He has denied any suggestion that would say that he couldn't get along with the national COVID-19 response team.
No, it's not getting along. It's about the culture of an organization, the work culture that I have, and also the culture. And definitely, if I can perform, I've worked 25 years internationally delivering. And if I cannot perform, I think the best thing is to let somebody else do the job.
Press reports claim that Senghor felt frustrated because he was allegedly sidelined by some top officials at the health ministry. that the government has not heeded to his advice not to allow a Belgian flight to bring 140 passengers into the country. Four passengers from that flight had escaped from quarantine control. They were later pursued by the government. Pa Samba Jau is a Gambian political analyst.
Why appoint somebody to be a coordinator when you're not going to listen to his advice? And the advice that he gave, if he gave them the advice that they should not allow that flight to come in because Gambia was not ready for it, that was a very sound advice. And that is the advice that should be expected from any genuine person. And to have just given that advice a deaf ear is not an insult only to Alassane, but to the whole Gambian population.
Gambia's health ministry has been marred by allegations of corruption. First to blow the whistle was Health Minister Amadou Lamine Samatte. Samatte had accused some staffers of his ministry of trying to steal money from the COVID-19 funds.
I believe that if we have a lot more Alassane Senghors, maybe our country would continue to move forward. But definitely, the lack of transparency, the lack of accountability, the lack of ethics, I think continues to really be an impediment to the development of that country.
Jau has called on the government to be more transparent and stop endangering the lives of Gambians. He says the airport should be closed to commercial flights. In another development, the Gambian government has confirmed the resignation of Justice Minister Abubakar Tambedou. A press release issued by the State House on Thursday said President Barrow has accepted Tambedou's resignation. Tambedou is taking up a job at the United Nations. He has been replaced by Daouda Diallo, a former judicial official. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pan Derimbay reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Families in the lower-income neighborhoods of Nairobi are using voucher community currency to pay for food during the coronavirus pandemic. More than 500 people a day are signing up with Kenyan Red Cross-supported community inclusion currency known as Sarafu to get food, soap, and other essentials. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
49-year-old Jane Mutuku is a resident of Makuru Kayaba, a slum in Kenya's capital, home to at least 80,000 people. The mother of six does manual work, but those jobs have been hard to come by in the past few months due to the COVID-19 pandemic. These days, she buys food using sarafu, a community e-voucher currency.
Kwa sahi, sina pesa yoyote kwa nyumba.
She says that for now she has no money. I looked for a job the whole of yesterday, she says, but didn't get any job. So I decided to use my sarafu to buy food, she adds. I have no food at home. Peter Odhiambo runs a food store in the area. His store is one of about 100 that accept the community currency. He says I can use the sarafu to buy goods in the area. For example, if I want to buy rice from the big stores, I buy using sarafu, he says. For the things that are not available in my community, I turn my sarafu into local currency within our established groups, he says. The groups help us to turn our sarafu into Kenya shillings. The shops in the area do about $10,000 worth of business each day using sarafu. Sarafu was developed by Grassroots Economics, an US-based engineering firm, Block Science. The firm puts financial contributions from donors into a community fund. The fund is leveraged to create and back the community credit. Roy Odhiambo is an innovation officer at the Kenya Red Cross.
One sarafu is equal to one Kenya shillings. So when we register the community, we are able to give them a token of 400 shillings that now they are able to purchase basic goods and services within the community. This sarafu is able to multiply if they are able to engage in income generating activities or even their businesses.
Like hundreds of thousands of Kenyans who have lost jobs, the people of Makuru Kayaba struggle to make a living. For Mutuku, she'll be able to prepare at least one meal for the day, thanks to the community inclusion currency. Mohammed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
This month, the United Nations warned of a global food emergency that it said might be caused by COVID-19, especially in regions such as Africa, where food production is already being hard hit by climate change. Sina Nafo, the climate change advisor to Malian President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta, spoke with Ricky Stryak about some innovative solutions that the country is trying.
We have the three buckets of solutions and innovations we are investing a lot of efforts into. First is technology, climate information services, having data, having spatial, geospatial data to have accurate and timely agricultural and weather information down to the farmer. So we're investing quite a bit in HAPS, in digital information. Second is finance. Finance, both risk mitigation tools like crop insurance, not just at the individual level, at the farmer level, but even for the economy. Again, in finance, apart from risk mitigation, it's funding. Unfortunately, as much as agriculture is the biggest sector in our economy, most of the banking, credit, don't go to the agriculture sector. So we're working with international partners to decrease the interest rates, to increase the maturity, and to have more access to concessional finance for our farmers.
Sine Nafo is the advisor on climate change to Malian President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta. You're speaking to Ricky Stryer from Germany. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the news that Liverpool have been crowned champions of England for the first time in 30 years after Manchester City lost 2-1 at Chelsea, meaning the Reds' 23-point lead at the top of the table is now unassailable. Liverpool's 4-0 triumph over Crystal Palace on Tuesday night meant only a Manchester City victory could prolong their 30-year wait for the title, but goals from Christian Pulisic of the United States and Willian meant City's title defense officially came to an end at Stamford Bridge. The club, which boasts of Senegal's forward Sadio Mane and Egyptian international Mo Salah, only lost one game on their way to winning the title. Jürgen Klopp is Liverpool's manager.
I have no words. It's unbelievable. It's much more than I ever thought what would be possible. Becoming chairman with this club is absolutely incredible.
Liberian international soccer player Anthony Snoti Lafour, who plays for Mamelodi Sundowns in South Africa, says he has no desire to enter into politics after his professional career. He describes President George Weah as a father figure to him. Lafour tells my colleague James Butty he's enjoying playing in South Africa.
South Africa is a beautiful country. I've been here almost 13 years. I won 6 league title already. I won the African Champions League. I play in the FIFA Club World Cup. I won the Super Cup. And I won 2 other domestic trophies in South Africa. So South Africa been very great. And I think I'm playing for one of the best teams in Africa, Mamelodi Sundowns. So yeah, I think I'm enjoying myself in South Africa.
Is soccer back in South Africa? Are you all playing now in South Africa?
No, soccer is not back in South Africa yet for the past 3 months because of this whole pandemic. But what we've been doing, we've been training on Zoom. As I'm speaking to you now, yesterday, the Minister of Sport, he came out. They want us to reopen our training and other things like that. So these are some of the things that they are talking about now.
Now to Nigeria, where the West African country is planning to transform sports from mere entertainment to business. Nigeria's Minister of Youth and Sports Development, Sunday Dare, said that plans were already in place to explore all appropriate avenues to transform the classification of sports in the country from mere recreation to a profitable economic activity.
We're close to delivering the first ever national sports industry policy. That is a policy that has a business model around sports that can create jobs for the mass of our youth, that can put value on our athletes from this country.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, June 26th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Samson Omale, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butty in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
Border Crossings. The Voice of America's Request Hour brings you an hour of great music and an escape from the news headlines, which aren't too good every single day. Tune in at 1500 Universal to Border Crossings. Make your requests by calling 202-619-207.